Good afternoon, and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast, The Rise of the Robot Overlords, Clarifying the Industrial IoT, Part 4, Why a Data Bus is So Unique. That is a very long title, but I'm sure you'll be very engaged in this webcast. My name is Rich Nass, and I am the Executive Vice President of Open Systems Media. I lead the embedded IoT teams for embedded computing design. But more importantly, I will be your moderator on this webcast today. On this webcast, you'll be hearing from one of the real stars in our industry and a frequent guest in this channel, and that would be Stan Schneider, who is the CEO of Real Time Innovations, also known as RTI. In Stan's spare time, he sits on the IIC Steering Committee and is its testbed chair. He received Embedded Computing Design's Top Embedded Innovator Award in 2015, and he was named as one of IoT1's top 10 most influential people in the industrial IoT sector in 2017. He holds a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science from Stanford University. So, without a doubt, he is very qualified to give this talk. Let me talk for a minute about the topic and what you can expect to learn from this webcast. This is part 4 of a 7-part series that all circles back to topics like IoT, industrial, robotics, security, and all that kind of stuff. What we'll talk about today is the data and the need for a data bus. That all sounds really exciting, and I'm looking forward to it. However, let me discuss some of the housekeeping stuff before we get there. The entire presentation will take about 40 to 45 minutes, give or take a few, and that'll leave us plenty of time to answer your questions, and we will answer as many as time permits. You'll find on your console window an area where you can enter your questions in real time. And as I said, we'll address as many as we can when Stan is done with his presentation. If we don't get a chance to answer your question, someone will get back to you after the webcast is over with an answer. If you have a question pertaining to the ECAST operation itself, like if the slides aren't advancing or you have a problem with the audio or something like that, put that question into the question box, and one of our technicians will get back to you. This webcast will be available in an archived version after we're done, so if you miss something and you want to go back and review, or if you want to show it to a friend, it'll be there waiting for you. Okay, that's about it. That's enough for me. Let's get into this webinar. Without any further ado, here is Stan Schneider. All yours, Stan. Take it away.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stan Schneider. This is actually part 4 of a webinar series that I got talked into doing by my marketing team actually is a great opportunity for me to sort of go in a little more depth on what I see as the state of the market and industrial IoT. Really, I think it's called Clarifying the Industrial IoT because I think there's an immense amount of confusion. Anyhow, I'm really excited about today because I get to talk about in a little more detail the data bus, which I think is really the new kid on the block in this world and a very different way of thinking about technologies. And I'm excited about having a chance to go into it, hopefully with enough depth that you can get an idea of what it's all about. So let's move on and see how that turns out. So first of all, I'm going to very quickly tell you how we got here. For those of you who weren't around for the previous presentations, first of all, I completely agree with this quote from Gartner, the smart machinery has been the most disruptive in the history of IT. I actually think, if anything, it's too weak of a quote. I would get rid of the of IT part. It really is the most disruptive thing in history. It's the ability to take compute systems and put them together with actuation in the real world is really quite new opportunity for us to make the world different and better. I also want to make it clear that the reason for this is the rise in the power of CPUs is just stunning. If you actually look 20 years out, it's about, assuming Moore's Law continues, and we can argue up and down whether it will or not, but even if it's off by orders of magnitude, it's still stunning. 20 years out, it's 10,000 times more capable processing. And 40 years out, it's 100 million times more capable processing. And that just means if you're building an industrial system, which typically have lifetimes, it might be 20 or 40 years. It really is the main thing you need to look at. And the other really important thing is networking is also exploding onto the scene. You'll see lots of, I have a collection of slides of how many things are going to be connected to the Internet of Things in the next 10 years. The only one I have that goes out 40 years is 275 billion. But I think, you know, there's definitely many, many, many more things online than there are people. And when you, you know, the value of a network is sometimes stated as the square of the number of nodes on the network. It really is an amazing statistic to think about the power of that, especially when combined with the processing. So that to me is, you know, really is the driving factor of sort of everything in our lifetimes and our kids' lifetimes is really going to make the world quite different. And I also think it's going to make it better. Today, you know, we have, we generate most power by burning things. We have an immense problem with things like errors in hospitals and inefficiency in the medical system. I started my career crashing cars for a living, and it's very dangerous and frustrating to drive and with human drivers out there, and also a lot of traffic. I think all of those things can be corrected over the next very short period of time, just by having more intelligent systems. But it's a big transition. It's amazingly threatening to a lot of things. I love this quote by John Chambers, you don't compete against competitors, you compete against market transitions. And this is the mother of all transitions. It's really going to change the world. Previously, I talked about, you know, what is the IoT? I think there's a lot of confusion around that. And, you know, what the practical guide, how you can actually pick apart all the different standards out there. I went into some detail on data centricity versus device centricity and used as an example two of the most popular standards, DDS and OPC-UA, which really focus on those different approaches. But one of the things that really has sunk into me in all of this studying that the IIC did and that I've done is not that these are many different ways to do the same thing. There are many different ways to do different things. And you really need to understand why they do things before you sort of choose one. It turns out to be a huge mistake to pick the wrong technology and go off and do your design around it. And maybe I'm biased towards connectivity technology, but I think connectivity really is, because it's the Internet of Things, it's an internet, it's a connectivity design. Choosing the right connectivity really overwhelms everything else. But of course, it's hard, which is why I'm doing this presentation here. The number one blocker in the industry is very clearly confusion. All of the standards, all of the players, a lot of them don't even understand what the other standards do or the other things do. But they use similar technology terminology for very different things. Just, you know, publish, subscribe, real-time Internet of Things and protocol, which sounds like a pretty clear thing, but there are at least four or five different standards that all say they are that, but they mean very different things by publish, subscribe. They have a completely different definition of real-time. Is it, you know, milliseconds or seconds or today? They have very different definition of what a thing is. Is a thing just a little device somewhere? Is a thing the entire Western grid? It's just, you can't listen to those words and make any sense out of it, unfortunately. So really the blocker out there is confusion. It's everywhere. I'm really, you know, involved with the IIC. Actually, the bio was a little bit wrong. I used to be the test bed chair, but I'm actually now the vice chair, which is a sort of higher level position. But I'm really excited about the IIC. The IIC is by far the largest of the alphabet soup of consortia in the industry. And it's also the most productive in a lot of ways. It kicks out what we call frameworks and guidance at a really high rate. There's usually at least a couple of significant white papers every month. And a lot of them, I think, are really great work, sort of overall architecture and security and analytics. And there's one that I'm going to focus on most today that is trying to pick apart and figure out how connectivity works. So you're going to see a lot of that. So the IICF, which is called the Industrial Connectivity Framework, really does three things. It puts together an architecture and a new stack design for industrial systems. The old seven-layer ISO stack, actually levels three and below, fit just fine, but above that it gets hard quickly. And then it goes through and puts together a template, an assessment template, really, of how to think about connectivity and the standards. We actually analyze six of the most, the six that we run into the most standards in some detail, and then help you with some selection guidance. As I alluded to before, the really shocking thing to me is these things don't overlap. They live in completely different spaces. Your application, if you're lucky, will land smack in one of these spaces, but many of them are just close to the space, and some of them are what I call interstellar space, where there really isn't a solution that will fit for you, but you should really take a look at this and figure it out. We, RTI, have taken that another step and put together some diagnostic questions I went over in the second webinar here, that you can ask yourself, and they aren't trying to be value proposition. They're just simple diagnostic questions to help you figure out where you belong in this space. And I'm going to talk about it a little more today, although not much. But you know, they're really simple. A lot of the questions are very simple, like if you said the word millisecond in the last 2 weeks, and are you or do you have software engineers on your project? Things like that really do change what you should be using in the future, because they really target very different application use cases. And the architectural challenge is huge, because in light of all of this, you're trying to put together an abstraction, which is sort of how you interact with a system that can let you put things together, affect integration, without making a spaghetti mess, which is coupling. And I went through that in some detail last time. And so that brings us to, you know, really why, this is about a data bus. So data bus is really a data-centric way of communicating. And I want to start out with why that makes any sense, why data centricity. And try and, if you aren't familiar with data centricity, it's a mindset change, and I don't want to understate that. Most people get lost in the mindset change, because it's really a different way of looking at things. So first, very, very quick definition. A data-centric technology connects applications to the data, not to each other. So you, as an application writer, only see an interface to data. Data may be moving and changing and have guarantees around it, like consistency or timing and things like that. But the fact that there are other applications out there is not something you have to concern yourself with. And so in the connectivity world, I'm going to compare it to a database in a second, which is also a data-centric technology. In database world, if you're using a database, and everybody here uses a database, if you're in marketing and you have a leads database, if you're in auto parts store, you have a database of parts. If you're in sales, you have a database of contacts, but you only interface with that database. You don't worry about all the marketing people that are putting those contacts into your sales database. You are just talking to the database. In the connectivity context, as a data-centric technology, your application is just talking to data, which actually looks like local memory or local thing. It's there, right there in your thread, in your process. And it doesn't fit into any of the boxes. So the boxes that you hear for other kinds of technology are messaging and client server and remote object invocation and publish subscribe and service-oriented architectures. You can build those things, all of them really, on top of a data bus or a data sector technology, but they're not the same. It doesn't fit in those boxes. I'll tell you what box I'll let you put it in later, but you have to stick with me for a few more slides first. So I just want to get across that it's quite different. So Databus and a database are both data center technologies. They're quite different. A database stores information, and then you can search it. So it's all about data store, usually a centralized concept. But the big difference is it's storing old information that you can then search. A data bus does exactly the same thing, exactly the same trick, same relational data model, but it doesn't store anything, at least not by default. It lets you find stuff in the future. So you can look for information that might happen later, and it can be fast enough so you can look for things like a vehicle coming close to me if I'm an autonomous car and I need to know about it after a second, or even a feedback sensor signal that might be updated 1,000 times a second or 3,000 times a second. You can look for that in the future, and the data bus will go out and get that for you. And then you can filter it and say, hey, I only want temperature readings that are over 300, and it won't send you anything else. So it really does the same kind of search capability, except it's not searching old stuff. It's setting up a filter to find you the right new stuff. And in both cases, the real fundamental benefit is there's truth. In database space, what's in the database is sort of, you know, guaranteed to be consistent. There's a thing called ACID properties that, you know it's sort of there. It's not going to get corrupted. In the data bus case, the truth is really all about availability of data. Do you actually have live sensors? Do you have reliability? Do you have things on time? Are you going to get flooded with data you don't know? So you can sort of think of it as a data table, but with parameters around it that specify how fast things move through that table and how you find them in the future. Both of them are pretty complex technologies. Both of them require a mindset change. If you're used to using a file system, for instance, for a database, and before you knew there was a database, you're going to have some sort of a change in the way you think of that. But really, you know, having a sense of truth and having a way to connect things together without having to write all that code yourself is hugely enabling. It's all the large systems out there and are built from databases today. I mean, you wouldn't dream today of building an enterprise system without a database, and I don't think you should think about building some kinds of IoT systems without a data bus. So, again, database guarantees no corruption. Database guarantees no corruption of stored data. A data bus guarantees things like fresh data, timing, rates, and reliability and security for future data. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. There's a website out there called the Data Centric Manifesto. Basically, it just has these principles and then a place to sign it. I signed it a long time ago. I suggest you go look at it. But basically, the whole idea of data centricity is data is owned by, and this is talking about organizations here. This is originally done by the insurance industry, I think. It's a key asset, and you don't need the application to interpret it. It should be available. And, you know, access to and, importantly, security is the data layer's responsibility, not yours as an application, which sounds simple but is amazingly, you know, if you're using a database and it's secure, you don't have to worry about that as an application writer. Same thing's true with a data bus. And the applications really just sort of visit data. They don't really do anything. And you know, once you catch the data-centric fever, many things suddenly make a lot of sense. If you first understand what a database can do, you would never think of building an employee tracking system or a supply chain management system without a database. That would be crazy. Nobody does that. Or an auto parts store. But all of those things existed well before the database abstraction came along. It just really made it easier to build scale and integration and make the application simpler if you have this powerful infrastructure that can do that kind of thing. So before that database came along, you'd have to read and write files, and you had special formats, you had a lot of special coding to make sure that you didn't corrupt your data. With the database, it's much simpler. The data bus does the same thing in a different world. So, anyhow, if I could summarize the power of data centricity, it really helps you enable scale and integration capability. So you can build an enterprise, and then the IIoT, it's doing the same kind of thing to enable scale and integration. So now that you know why, I want to really try and blow your mind a little bit. If you're a programmer, and I'm hoping a lot of you are programmers, you were taught object-oriented from Computer Science 101. And objects are things that exist in code, and sort of mantra is encapsulate the data and expose your methods. And it's very aimed at sequential execution. You call an object, you call a method on an object, and then it returns, and then you call the next one. It fits well with the sort of way computer processors work, and probably your thinking works, that you do something, and then you do the next thing, and then you do the next thing. And the problem is it's very hard to be parallel. So the reason for doing that is because the data structures, you want to sort of keep those from being exposed to others so you can change them, and the methods theoretically change slower. But in reality, trying to extend that to a distributed system really didn't work. It's great for a single-threaded program that's linked together in one CPU, but when you're distributed, you want to do things like, how fast can you call this interface? What happens if there's no response? How do I know every sensor is alive? How do I know the difference between I didn't get a sensor update and the sensor is just dead and not talking to me? What happens if a whole bunch of applications call this method at the same time? How does it change their rate of return or the reliability of the system? It just doesn't scale well when you go distributed. It's not parallel. And then basically because every call is independent. So, the early distributed systems like DCOM and Olay and Corba just tried to keep this concept of object-oriented and extend it to a distributed system. And that was useful, and the paradigm helped, but when you really try and scale and make it big, it falls apart. It's famously difficult, even on a single CPU, for instance, to have many methods in parallel. When you've got lots of parallel execution, think of 100,000 devices all working independently, it becomes untenable. So, I'm going to ask you to abandon your familiar abstraction of object-oriented. Not that you can still use it in your programs, but abandon that whole idea and do the least intuitive thing, throw it away and have the exact opposite. Instead of encapsulating data and exposing methods, I want you to encapsulate your methods. Actually, we're going to take all the methods away from you because the standard specifies them. And expose the data you want to share. And there's no more sequential execution. Now it's all parallel. So it really is the diametric opposite in a lot of ways. And the reason for doing that is because that's the way the real world works. The real world, if you walk down the street, you're walking down the street, but all the other people walking down the street and cars going down the street and birds flying and earth spinning and everything else is happening in parallel at the same time. If you're going to build a big distributed system, computing system, you need to be able to do that same kind of thing. So we're going to take away the whole idea of sequential execution and object orientation, and we're going to replace that with its opposite of parallel execution and data centricity. And you're going to explicitly have a shared data model that you're going to send to everything else. And we're going to control that through something called quality of service. We'll talk about that. It's very flexible. You're going to join it with a clear data interoperable data structure. It's going to scale massively. You can take advantage of any transport you have, multicast, redundancy, timing, reliability, filtering, security. All those things are going to be done for you, and you're going to get to write your application, which you can still write the application object-oriented, but you're going to write your application in a completely different way. And it's hard to get that across to people who are new to the concept. I'm going to go back to the database for a second because you are used to that concept. That's a well-known technology now, and show you that these things are really quite similar. The purpose is different. Seek future information instead of storing old information. But, you know, you'll hear things like it's messaging. Well, no, it's not messaging any more than a database is a file. You'll hear it's a protocol. Well, no, it has a protocol, just like a database has a file format. Okay, it's quite different concept. You know, they'll say it's publish-subscribe. Well, no, it does publish-subscribe, just like a database does query-response, but it's not the same as publish-subscribe. It has some guarantees. I'll talk about those in a second. There are schema, which is in the data table, a data table. In fact, the data bus has a data table. It also has timing stuff around that data table. And then, you know, there's, it actually, you know, very similar after that. It's records, it's indexed by keys, there's fundamental business, scale, reliability, and truth. It has data with a life cycle, it's called CRUD, create, read, update, delete. It has data access that's relational. You find data by giving it a specification for what you are looking for. And security is just part of the architecture. So it's actually quite similar. So what is a data bus? First of all, the abstraction is really important. I talked about this last time, but the abstraction, which means what it looks like, is all data is available everywhere all the time. Obviously, that's ridiculous. We can't actually send all the data everywhere. There's a lot of data. Just like you can't, I can't send you, if you're walking down the street, the exact positions of every pedestrian on the sidewalk worldwide. That wouldn't make any sense. But you could say something like, well, I only really need the ones I might run into, so I want the ones within 10 feet of me and moving towards me. So if you, the trick is that we make it appear you can select any set of that data. We make it appear that it's available to you. You have to tell you when you get it. You know, I only want the ones within 10 feet. I want to know that within half a second. You know, you have to tell me that. And when you give me that kind of a specification, me being the data bus, I can go out and figure out if I can provide that to you. And if I can, then I can wrap some guarantees around it. So rather than give you everything, we're just going to figure out everything you need and give you that. So it's a great way to do that. And then you only talk to the data. You don't talk to the other pedestrians or anything else. They're the sensors directly. You talk to the data. And it really makes everything able to communicate without coupling, which is very nice. If you have to put this in a box, put a data bus in a box, put it in a box of a distributed shared memory. It's more like that than anything else. DDS, by the way, is the standard that describes a data bus. They're not really the same thing any more than SQL is a database. It's just the API and one of the wire specs, so one of the ways to communicate between the data buses things. So it's really important to also understand why that's good from a programming point of view. Data centricity, and you gotta think now, you're just writing code that's only talking to what looks like local data. You're going to have to do things like tell exactly what local data you want and what you have, and you know, promise to do things like I'm a sensor and I'm updating this position of, or this temperature or whatever, and I'm going to update that 10 times a second. You have to sort of promise you're going to do that, and then the data bus is going to hold you to that promise. If you don't do it, it's going to tell everybody that it was trying to deliver data to it as a failure of your sensor, unless there's some redundant source. But by doing that, now you're only talking locally. If you think about it for a little bit, it separates all these applications in flow, space, and time. So they can share information, the previous slide, but now, you know, it'll automatically discover things because I know the rates all the data is being updated, the data bus. I know all the rates things are being updated. I know the rates everybody else wants it. I can decide if I can do those. Reliability I can do individually. I can, I'm not asking you what network or transport, how you get the data. And every single flow, we have systems with 10 million independent flows, we can do this quality service trick for. It's also separated in space. If you're just getting the data and you're just talking what looks locally, you don't know if that data is being generated from a device that's on your same board or in the fog somewhere or in a cloud. You can move applications and sensors around completely transparently because nobody's dependent on that. And you can have 20 sensors as long as, you know, they're all, I can get the data from any one of them. I can have redundancy. I can have multiple algorithms running in parallel. Everything's very parallel. And they're also separated in time because there's no such thing as a startup sequence. It's part of my process. It's already running. And, you know, maybe I can't get my guaranteed data update, but I don't have to wait for something else. It makes perfect sense for a sensor to come up and start writing its data, even though there's nothing else there. You see, there's no servers. We'll talk about that in a second. Participants can come and go anytime they want. And so the short-term time, getting the system up and running and moving things in and out is independent. And through another trick I don't have time to talk about today, unfortunately, if the schema changes, if you change your definition of what data you have or data you need, we're going to get smart about that because the data bus knows what your definition and knows what the source's definition is, for instance, and we're going to match that for you. So you can update a system with 100,000 devices and parts in it incrementally, even if the schema changes. So it really separates them in those three dimensions. And then if you know RTI, we have a tagline. This is really what it comes from. Decoupled systems can work independently. They aren't dependent on startup order and stuff I just talked about, flow rates. And because they can share through the data, they can cooperate, and that's where we get our tagline, which is your systems working as one, because now they're systems, they're still working together independently, but they still work they can also work together as one. I'm going to go through one slide on how the technology works, because you probably should understand that. That's interesting. And the way the technology works, there's this fiction, this virtual shared global data space. It doesn't exist anywhere. It's not a database. It's not stored anywhere. It doesn't exist. It's just an abstraction. But it's the abstraction that all data is available. And there's some data already out there in our little example here. And the data, everything is sort of automatically discovered. Every participant knows all the data out there. And how does that work? I can't really explain because discovery is a built-in topic. It's a built-in data thing. So you have to understand how it works before you can talk about how discovery works. I'm going to sit there and have my little application that reads it right in my language and my operating system with my transport. I don't even necessarily need to know my language and operating system, obviously, but it's irrelevant to the rest of the system. And I'm going to come along in my little example here, which we just made up, and I'm going to be a sensor on the street or whatever, and I'm going to write something I call an obstacle. I made that name up. Here's the type of an obstacle, the schema. It has X and Y and velocities and maybe the type of obstacle or whatever. And it has quality services attached to it. And in this case, this quality services, I've just got two of them. DDS has 22 of them. I'll talk about it in a second. My two are how fast I'm going to update it 100 times a second, and I have 1,000 buffers so I can keep it alive for 10 seconds. I can update you reliably for 10 seconds. I can retry if you don't get what you want. And along comes another one. So the instant I do that, everybody discovers it. Everybody knows this exists. That's sort of magic. And the other one says, hey, I want to read obstacles. I can only handle them 10 times a second. Just don't have the bandwidth to 100 times a second. I don't want to be dependent on the sensor anyway, right? I only want the ones that are close to me and ones that are moving because I don't want to hit them. I don't want them to hit me. And you notice the little arrow says contract. You've now made a contract with the data bus. It's actually a local concept. It happens in your thing. And all the data bus does is look locally on both sides and says, hey, do I have a source if I'm trying to get data? And do I have somebody to send it to if I'm trying to send it. So, yeah, in this case, that guy over there wants it 10 times a second, but only if it's close. I know the data structure inside. I can do that math. It's actually part of the little language. It's like SQL inside of the DDS spec. It says, yep, I can send it. I'll send it 10 times a second if it's close. And think about for a second what this really means. If I had 50 sensors for that same obstacle, any one of them would be acceptable to you. If some of them are running 100 hertz like this one is, and some of them are running 10 hertz, and some of them are running 5 hertz, well, the five hertz one isn't fast enough, can't send that one. The 100 hertz one I can send every 10th one. The 10 hertz one I can send everyone. You are now, as a receiver, completely independent of the design of the sender. Another thing that you may have missed here, when I put the second obstacle up, it has type prime. It's slightly different than the other one. Maybe you're a newer device than the one out there that's on the pole, so I have extra fields. Well, that type is now registered with the data bus as another type, and the data bus is going to match those automatically as it sends it. It's going to strip out or add in some fake field, or it's going to strip out, and it's very well defined in the standard, part of the standard called X types. And, you know, so now we got typeware matching the actual communications directly peer-to-peer. There's no servers involved. Didn't say that I had to start a server or anything like that anywhere in this thing. So it can do things in milliseconds. It's completely redundant. And I just talked about a couple of the quality services. There's many others, including timing, reliability, security, all sorts of stuff like that. So this whole concept of quality service is pretty interesting. A data bus is a data flow control technology. The quality service controls that flow, and there's a match. So you can request a quality service, and you can offer a quality service. There's a match when the request and offered policies are somehow compatible. In my example before, they don't have to be the same. You know, it's just got to be more reliable than required or more faster than required or something like that. Databus is going to enforce those. If it doesn't have a sensor that is capable of supplying it, it's going to call that an error. If it has, you know, one of the quality services called liveliness, it will guarantee that there's at least one sensor capable of doing this, or else you'll get a notification, things like that. Example here is deadline, which specifies how long until I get my next update. If I ask for 5 milliseconds and somebody offers 10 milliseconds, that's not going to match because the data is too old. If I ask for 5 milliseconds and offers 2 milliseconds, it'll match. I mean, you can't actually get exactly 5 seconds with 2 milliseconds there, so there's another quality service that handles that case. But yes, it is in this case, the data is current enough. And there's lots of other quality services. Here is a quick overview of them. The core of data centricity is to provide an interface that's sufficiently robust and powerful to define the entire interaction. You don't need to know the other stuff. So that is sort of a very different way to look at things. And some consequences of quality of services that you can have. You can have many different kinds of flows. This is actually an example from an autonomous car with cameras and LIDARs and radars and things like that that come at different volume and different frequencies. And by having different quality of service regions, we can handle all of them with the same abstraction and the same bus. It's incredibly easier than having lots of different buses and things like that. Another thing that I'm going to talk about in a lot more detail on my next one here is security. And I'm certainly not saying you should get rid of all the other things in security. You know, defense in depth is important. But there's data defense here. There's the normal things, you know, system edge like firewalls, hosts like whitelists and things like that, and network transports that are encrypted, those are all just fine. But the data bus, because it is a data flow control technology, can just add security as essentially another data flow control. Do you have permission to get this data? And it works without having any extra stuff, just like a database security works, just by turning it on. You turn it on, and there's no API, there's no code to write. It just secures the application interactions themselves. It's actually much harder to hack in a lot of ways than the other ones because you can't get anything other than that one little piece if you get into it. We'll talk about that more. It also scales very nice because you have this abstraction of all the data is everywhere. You can build larger things. This is an example from a oil gas industry. By building multiple layers, you can build larger systems. Between those layers, you have to have some way to map the data model, the lower layer, to the higher layer. So the subsystem has some, like this example from an autonomous car world, has things like sensors and actuators and controllers in the vehicle. It wants to export some data, so it'll have some level of export. And to the larger system here, which is maybe a traffic control for a whole city, it's just, or for a street area, it's just, you know, here's a vehicle and this vehicle's moving, and a much simplified version of that subsystem, and importantly, only one security domain. And we have a product, actually part of our product called the routing service, that does exactly that, makes that map so you can scale. And some examples, these are actually real examples. NASA's launch control system for Orion is a huge system. It's actually, they say it's the largest, at least single system SCADA on the planet. Many, hundreds of thousands of data things going around. You want to be able to, you know, at the launch pad, you got event domains, you got lots of data flow, very critical. To work, it's got to have a lot of ability to have redundancy and things like that. You have lots of event domains, lots of sensors and actuators out there. And then you got to get it to the firing room where you can see those rows and rows of monitors with HMIs, and you want to record things out of the launch pad. You want to record what happened in the firing room. I don't have time to talk about persistent service, but you want to support late joiners and things like that. It really makes... and makes this large system work. That's just one example. Here's another real example, Grand Coulee Dam, which is the largest power plant in North America of any type. It's got something like 300,000 data values in it, very, very availability sensitive, so it's got a lot of redundancy in the routing and what they call the segments, things like pump houses and grid switch yards, displays, and all that kind of stuff. All these things can easily be redundant, and it can scale into a large system. You know, here's one from GE Healthcare at a large hospital. Their design is for 1,200 rooms, 300 different types of devices, and 300,000 devices in a hospital. It really has to deal with scale and integration and all these kinds of things, and finding the right patient data and all of that stuff is really hard unless you have a relational model that helps you out with it. It's, you know, some example. I've got many other examples in my previous talks. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I do want to get a data bus is not a protocol any more than a database is a file format. It has a protocol. The green line down here is, you know, this is our product, stack. The green thing down here, this, RTPS is the messaging protocol. A data bus has many, many more things like that. And really, like any complex product, any big product, it's more than just that. That's just one piece of other pieces that has things like security and people that do services and tools and what we call runtime services, like the routing service I talked about, but also record and replay and persistence and database integration and queuing and all sorts of things like that. And then utilities to debug it and things like that. It's really a useful database has to really be a complete product, not just things. It's very different than just a protocol. So you might want to ask, well, why a data bus and do I need one? Because I told you at the beginning, these applications are very, very different. They live in different worlds, and you should find if you are in a compelling use case. And first of all, you know, data bus, if you're doing sort of the traditional, what we call device monitoring, I talked about this earlier, device monitoring IoT, where you just have a single device talking to a single cloud service, you know, the entire consumer IoT here, like a Nest thermostat or a Fitbit or a Ring doorbell, you know, those are good examples of device monitoring. In the industrial space, you'll hear things like predictive maintenance. You're just going to see if this motor's getting too hot or vibrating too much or something. Doesn't really fit that. If you're just trying to collect a lot of data and send it one way to the cloud for optimization, like, you know, GE Predix and things like that, where you're just doing analytic optimization of a big plant, it doesn't really fit that. But if you're trying to do edge autonomy, or you're trying to, the real hard thing is connecting together in real time, or even not in real time, but you know, connecting together algorithms and sensors and actuators and stuff in an application, not in a data center, in the real world, it really fits there. And there's other things that also work down there. But a data bus is really most useful if you face problems that it solves very cleanly. So what happens if your system stops working for a minute? Anything with a server, you're not going to reboot a server and make all the reconnections in a minute. So, and, you know, because it supports redundancy so nicely, it's hard to get it to fail even in the first place. So, you know, if you're going to kill somebody or crash a car or take down a power grid, if you're down for a minute, check that box. You know, if you said millisecond in the last 2 weeks, well, it's all peer-to-peer, so it does that very well. It really is a software integration technology. So if you have a lot of software, it doesn't mean you have to have 10, but if you have 10, you have a big interface problem. It automates all those interfaces very nice. It's really designed to send data from many destinations, which any pub sub kind of system would do. But it's really also, you know, it's a new design. Almost all data bus users are building something, either a big retrofit like Grand Coulee, or they're building something new like an autonomous car. Yeah. If you answer three of those yes, I can comfortably say you belong in the data bus universe. If, you know, five of them, you're smack in the middle of it. If, you know, one or two, you're probably not. You're far away. Do something else. Even help you tell you what to do something else. We have a little guide out there. But if you actually look at where we find traction, you know, there's an amazing number of applications. They span the industrial Internet of Things. All of these actually answer at least three of those questions I just showed you. It's really a technology that builds, you know, most things are connecting intelligence to all the sensors. It's really about autonomy. And these are sort of the applications we see as early adopters. I talked about that before. Almost all of them are taking this idea of having functional artificial intelligence and connecting it to real networking. A great example is autonomous vehicles, where it takes the challenge of all the data that current designs, what's called level three, typically solved by putting everything into a single box, a centralized design, and let you now have distributed shared memory and replace all those wires and things with a fast network and have a completely new architecture. DDS has a lot of traction. We're going to talk about the next webinar, the one after, is all about autonomous vehicles. Virtually all the standards platforms like AUTOSAR and ROS and things like that are now specifying DDS for higher levels of autonomy. It really fits that very well. We'll talk about how and why when I get to that, and I'm teasing you with future things here a little bit. But the reason why it does this, there's no servers, so it can have redundancy, it can scale, you don't have to worry about where to put servers, you don't have to provision them, you don't have to worry if they're going to get flooded, you don't have to worry about if they're up or down, you don't have to reboot them, you don't have to back up their state, there are no servers. It can handle secure multicast and reliable multicast, with its specifications. It lets you only send data that you really need instead of sending all the data to everybody. Because the interface management is now handled by the data bus, it helps build big software projects. And because of data flow quality service insulate you from the network capabilities, you can work over different networks and even change your network later. You know, there's a lot of practical architecture rules we've learned over the years. You know, this is just sort of for any architecture. You know, abstraction should separate concerns, plan for your scale and evolution in the future, adopt open standards where possible. It really helps you do that. One of the most important things is to actually have well-defined layers. One of the reasons the IFC defined a new stack architecture for industrial systems is the Internet IP ISO 7 layer stack just doesn't work for a lot of these kinds of demands that you see in industrial systems. It's different. And then maybe one of the most important things is, you know, we're is complex. If you're going to go look into DDS, I'm going to warn you right now, your first reaction is, oh my gosh, this is amazingly complex. But if you ever took a database course in college, you had that same reaction. It, you know, it seems like a simple concept, but when you actually dig into it a little bit and you have to do data tables and understand ACID properties and things, it's a very much different thing. But it makes your application much simpler. So fundamentally, if you're going from a message-centric to a data-centric view of the world, you're taking a lot of stuff that you used to have to do in your code and moving it into an infrastructure that's going to do it all for you. It very much simplifies your application logic. It also makes it much easier to have a big teams build different things because they're all doing the same thing. You don't have to coordinate all of that with them. So it really is a very different world. So in summary, you know, why a data bus? Well, first of all, it's data-centric, and that gives you integration freedom, makes it much easier to build things. It's independent modules, so you, once you've done your data table design, you can split it up to all of your team, or and they can work, and their things are going to work together, and importantly, if they update things at different times, it'll also match that. Because it specifies so much of the interaction without actually requiring that interaction, you can deploy it different than you develop it. We see a lot of that in autonomous cars, like developing a test system with a big, you know, rack of computers in the back of the car, and now they want to put it into ECUs and take algorithms and put them into different places. It's completely deployment flexibility. It's fast, scales, and it's also very standards-based. I didn't talk about that here, but there's standard both for the API level, so you can switch vendors, and at the protocol level, so if you actually have different parts of the thing that use different DDS vendors, they will interoperate at least in some side, some way. So, you know, all the ill at ease here, scalability and resilient ability. So that's not really one, but real time secure safe, that's sort of what it does. Before I get off, I'm going to very quickly, you know, where can you learn more? I'm going to give a quick plug for our ConnexCon that's coming up in just a few weeks here. We're actually going to do it at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. So if you're in Silicon Valley, you should come to that. If you're most people there will be users, but we do allow a lot of others to show up too. We have some great speakers there. Silicon Valley's full of autonomous car startups and things like that. So we have some of our customers here that are going to talk about their technical designs in autonomous cars, and one doing a really cool, amazing, actually, medical robot called Oris. But, you know, Techno FMC is an autonomous underwater vehicle. Apex AI and Zoox are building autonomous cars, and GM is working with AutoSAR to have a standard that includes DDS for sort of more traditional OEM approaches. We also have our first advisory board meeting there. You can talk to some interesting people. They will do a panel and hang out with you for a little bit. Scott McNeely's there, who's an ex-CEO of Sun. We have a sort of star in the power industry, Rayford Smith. KT Newman is an automotive. He actually is the CEO of Conti, which is one of the big tier ones, as well as Opel and GM Europe. We have a new exciting market for DDS and simulation, large distributed real-time simulation, and the chair of the largest consortium called NCS is on our advisory board. And then Nick, someone we worked with for years, sort of a historical understanding of how the Navy ended up adopting DDS everywhere. Anyhow, you can get to interact with them a little bit. And of course, you've got our websites, all full stuff. We have a new website. I should put a picture of it. If you do nothing else, go watch the homepage for our website for 2 minutes after this talk. You'll see all sorts of really cool new stuff. I do have an ebook that has a lot of this in it, including a chapter called Why a Data Bus is So Unique. I can recommend you get that. You can get that on our website. And the next one of these things, we'll talk about security. Before I run out of time altogether, also please connect with me. I like that. I will pass it back for questions.
Thank you very much, Stan. That was awesome. And I'm anxious to get your book. I'm going to do that right after we're done here. Okay, we have a few minutes left to answer some questions. As we said in the beginning, please enter them into the console. We will get to as many as we can, and we'll see what happens. Okay, Stan, start you off with an easy one. Is RTI the only provider of the data bus architecture?
No, we're the biggest. We're certainly the loudest. We are the most experienced, but we're hardly the only one. There's 16 implementations of DDS standard that we know of. You know, there's probably four of them are vendors. There's some open source versions, although some of the open source, I won't name names here and get myself in trouble, is really very bad, so bad that people try it and then say, I tried DDS and it sucks. So please realize these things are vastly different. If you really want to do open source, I recommend you get our free version, play with that for a while, and then play with the open source, so at least you'll understand how DDS is supposed to work before you get frustrated with it. So.
Very good. Okay. Next one. What's the difference between a data bus and publish subscribe?
Great questions, actually, in the ebook. So they're not the same. Publish subscribe is a pattern. A data bus is an architecture that can support many patterns. Actually, it's fundamentally built on publish subscribe, but next part of the spec has request reply, which is sort of the more normal client server pattern. We RTI supports queuing, as do other vendors. You know, pub sub is a pattern. It's good for parallel stuff. Request reply is better for one-on-one, but it's not about that. It's about the interaction is with the data, not some other active entity. That's really what it's about. So if you do request reply to a data bus, you are actually requesting the data to do something, not some particular service or some particular thing. You're saying, hey, data, you know, I'd like to set your objective, there's this thing called the objective state pattern, to be 23, and it will go out and come back and say, yeah, well, I've set it to 23, but you're not interacting with something, you're interacting with the data. Also, most PubSub is really primitive. You know, you register some interest, and then everything is sent to you. A data bus, because it is a relational system, actually, is much more things. So, you know, in my example with the vehicles that I did there, you know, if there's 10,000 cars on the road, PubSub is going to send all 10,000. We're just going to send the ones that are very close to you, that are moving, that are, you know, and if you only want it 10 times a second, I'm not going to send it 200 times a second, you know, and I'm going to guarantee it actually exists and that kind of stuff. Just, it is sort of like PubSub is just much, much richer control of the interface and the data flow. That makes sense.
Okay, very good. Yep, sure makes sense. Would a blockchain be considered as a manifestation of a data structure with data centricity?
Wow, I've got to parse that for a while. No, I don't know what that means. I don't see how that's... A blockchain is a useful thing that might be play with a data-centric system, but it's not really a data structure. It'd be hard to think of it as a data structure like that. It's really, I don't think of blockchains that way anyway. I'm not a blockchain expert. But.
Okay. Just one more because we're just about out of time. I think this is a good one. Is a data bus really a database that you interface to with PubSub?
No, because a database stores stuff. Data bus, everything I talked about, you know, we do have three ways to store things. An RTI, there are really services we add on top of it. But fundamentally, a database is storing stuff, and the data bus is delivering stuff as it's being developed, as it's being created. It doesn't store anything. You can interface databases, PubSub, sort of. It's not really a well-developed technology, but it's really all about storing stuff, and usually centrally. DataBus isn't a central concept at all, and it doesn't store anything by default, and it doesn't have any ACID properties. It does do eventual consistency, but it's really quite different than a database because it's future data, not old data.
Okay.
Fundamentally different.
Very good. I'm afraid that's all we have time for.
Boring in here.
Yeah. Well, as I said in the beginning,
really,
if you ask the question,
look at some of these questions. Look at all these great questions. I just got to answer one here. Maybe I don't have time. The whole no servers one that John somebody submitted. That was a great question. Oh well.
Well, we can get back to folks after the fact. We know who they are. We know where to find them, and that's what we told them. I'd like to thank Stan for an outstanding presentation and RTI for sponsoring this event. A final reminder that all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without our permission. So thank you, Stan. And, of course, we can never do any of these things without the engineer. So thank you all for attending, and have a great day.